We are joined now from the studios of Georgetown University by Joseph A. Martin. He's a professor of history, also directs the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. His book on that historic strike, which was by air traffic controllers in the early months of the Reagan administration, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks, Kat. Good to be with you.
Professor McMartin, why don't we start with kind of the legal framework? Why is it that federal workers aren't allowed to strike?
Federal workers aren't allowed to strike. It's always been part of the law. The law that governs right now was passed in 1978, and that law has forbidden federal workers from striking. But even before that law, going back to 1962, when John F. Kennedy issued the first executive order that allowed for federal workers to have limited collective bargaining, one of the important stipulations of that order was that federal workers might unionize, they might be able to bargain about some things. Most of your reader or listeners might not know that federal workers cannot bargain over their wages or benefits, for example. They might be able to bargain over some things, but they cannot strike. That was put to the test in 1981, of course, when the air traffic controllers defied the law, did stage a strike, and then were fired. More than 11,000 of them were fired and replaced by President Ronald Reagan's actions.
So, like, there the consequence the union faced was just other air traffic controllers got brought in, got trained up, and a lot of them eventually kept those jobs. This is a different economy, though. Unemployment's near an all-time low. A lot of the federal workers who are out are skilled professions that it would be hard to replace. Isn't it kind of a different terrain for workers going on strike now?
In some ways, that might be true, but in 1981, when the controllers did strike, they were pretty confident. They believed that because they were highly trained professionals, it took about 5 years to create a fully trained air traffic controller, that it would be impossible to replace all of them if they went out on strike. About 70% actually stayed out. So the economy has changed, but that one example that exists, I think, continues to provide a kind of inhibiting factor for federal workers. They look back at what happened to PATCO, and they think, well, you know, a strike could be disastrous.
As an alternative to a strike, you are proposing a spontaneous sick out. How does that work?
Well, you know, while federal workers can't strike, that doesn't mean that they haven't over the years used a variety of different kinds of resistance to try to get their point across. After the Kennedy executive order in 1962, for example, air traffic controllers were among the first to try to organize a union in the 60s. They didn't try to do strikes in their early years because they were forbidden. Instead, they used two techniques that were quite effective. One was a technique that union people will be familiar with. It's called working to rule. That is, they followed very closely the FAA's rule book to the point where it actually snarled air traffic. And that was a thing that could create slowdowns and backups throughout the system. It was one tool that they used to get the FAA to hire more air traffic controllers. The second thing that they did on a couple of occasions is that they staged sick outs, mass call-ins of workers who said that they couldn't report to work because they felt ill, and those again snarled the air traffic system and created enough pressure to bring about change. In fact, PATCO as a union was formed in part because of one of those sick outs that happened in 1970, which in fact help pave the way for the union's recognition a couple of years later as the bargaining organization for air traffic controllers. So federal workers and, in fact, public sector workers of all kinds have found ingenious ways to try to bring pressure to bear when an out-and-out strike isn't practical.
How long could something like a sick out go on before it's bordering on breaking the law. I mean, obviously, like 10,000 people are obviously not collectively sick for a month together.
Right. If it happened in the right parts of the federal workforce, it wouldn't take a month. If sick out rates hit 20%, if sick rates hit 20% in TSA and, say, among air traffic controllers, that would pretty much bring our air traffic system to, you know, a crawl. And I don't think that political leaders would tolerate that for long. I think right now that might be the best way to actually end this stalemate we're in, because I think whatever they say in public, I believe Republicans in the Senate might actually be relieved if they were forced to take some action to bring this government shutdown to a halt.
You mean they need political cover, even if it's making a punching bag of federal workers, political cover to start the government back up again?
I think they need some reason to be able to break with President Trump. They've shown very little willingness to do that now. I don't know what would cause them to actually break with him other than being forced to by some change in the current status quo. How can we change the status quo? I'm not sure that public opinion polls are going to do it. It might be that federal workers themselves have to bring about a change in that status quo.
We're speaking to Joseph A. McMartin. He's a professor of history at Georgetown, where he directs the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. He is a student of collective direct action by organized labor. His books include Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. This was a public sector strike early in the presidency of Ronald Reagan, one that he successfully broke by firing the striking workers because they were technically in violation of federal law, which does not allow federal government employees to go on strike. Joseph McMartin, let's talk about kind of the details of an effective sick out. I take it it can't actually be coordinated by union officialdom because then they would face legal consequences.
Well, I think that's exactly right. If a sick out were to develop, it would not be a thing that union leadership could go out front and call for, lest they suffer consequences of promoting an illegal work stoppage. And I think labor leaders in all of the major federal unions, again, are very mindful of that example from the past of what happened with PATCO. If they were to defy the law by calling for and promoting through their union a collective action to try to bring an end to this stalemate, they would risk their unions losing certification as the bargaining units for the workers they represent. And I think one thing they all know is that this administration would prefer to get rid of federal unions altogether. So I think they're cautious about that.
So then the types of sick outs you referred to earlier, like the ones that preceded the formal creation of the Air Traffic Controllers Union, what kind of entity played that coordinating function?
Often it was work groups in specific locations. Among air traffic controllers, workers in air traffic controllers in some strategic locations could have a huge impact through the whole system. When it came to, say, working to rule, actually the controllers who handle air traffic around the Bay Area were very powerful. There's a facility called Bay Tracon, which is one that directs traffic around the airports of the Bay Area. And controllers in that facility, just by adhering closely to the rule book, were able to slow down air traffic in the Bay Area in ways that spread all through the system. Same was true at O'Hare Airport. So if workers were to work to rule or to call in sick at strategic locations, and often this can be, you know, maybe promoted by workers in those locations. They know the official union can't, that their national union can't get out in front and call for that. It might come, dawn on them that this is the only way that they have to bring a change in the current situation.
Are you aware of any organizing that's actually happening on the ground? Like, I've heard experts like yourself talk about this as an option, but do you know at all if federal workers are starting to lean in this direction as they become frustrated?
I am not. I'm not personally trying to advise anybody about that. I'm just recalling what the lessons of history have been. I don't know the degree to which federal workers in different locations might be considering something like this. But it would not surprise me in the least if, as this stretches now, as you say, into day 26,
I wonder.
People are looking at, but yeah.
No, I was just saying, I wonder, though, we know that this president is a president that digs his heels in whenever he's challenged. And his reaction to what he would feel is an obvious ploy by the workers may just cause him to dig his heels even further.
He might well do so, but again, the question would be, would Republican leaders continue to dig in with him? The situation that federal workers are in today is quite different in a couple of significant ways from where the air traffic controllers were in 1981. And so I don't think the public would stand behind Trump today the way they stood behind Reagan then. First of all, when air traffic controllers struck in 1981, they were clearly openly defying the law. That put Reagan in a position where he had to fight them almost. Second, they were fairly well-paid workers, and they were going on strike at a time when the economy was slowing down, unemployment was rising, and they were asking for a significant raise when other unions were involved in concessionary bargaining in 1981. They were, in other words, not terribly sympathetic to a lot of the American public, whereas I think federal workers today, I think people would understand why people felt so sick of the situation they're now confronting. Maybe having to have a second pay period go without a paycheck. And the stress that they're working under in many of these environments if they felt too ill to continue in that kind of capacity.
The anecdotal evidence we have is that a large number of workers, particularly like the low-paid Transportation Security Administration luggage screeners, are calling in sick, and that's partly because they got to go out and drive Uber or drive Lyft just so they can pay the bills at the end of the month. But what you're suggesting
exactly.
is that would need to be combined with work to rule, which means following every minor rule that can slow down the process of getting work done. Right now, the anecdotes are that people are kind of like, you know, the few TSA agents on the job are waving people through the lines, not running the full body scanners, missing stuff in luggage with a pretty high rate. You're saying what would be effective is being extra meticulous right now?
That might be one thing that they could do. I think we should all be concerned if people are just being waved through the lines. It's another bit of evidence that this is a really, you know, increasingly dangerous situation that the president has created. And it might be that only workers themselves have the ability to intervene in this and try to force a resolution.
Again, that is Joseph A. McMartin, professor of history at Georgetown University, where he also directs the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. His book on the last major federal workers' strike, the one that effectively ended the union, that called it Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. He joins us from the studios of Georgetown University. Professor McCartan, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you.